Testing. 1, 2, 3. My name is Andrew Bailey. It is Sunday, May 13th, 2007, and we are in Savannah, Georgia. I'm here to interview Ed Colson as part of the United States Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society Oral History Project. Ed had a successful professional career before and after the SEC and held several significant positions at the SEC, concluding with that of the Chief Accountant of the Commission in the Office of the Chief Accountant. Ed, I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to talk to you today and about your experiences as a member of the SEC staff. Perhaps we could start or begin with a little background about your early childhood. I understand you grew up in Pennsylvania.
Oh, sure, Andy. And by the way, thank you. Welcome to Savannah.
Thank you.
I basically was born in a small town about 30 miles outside of Pittsburgh. My job in the morning when I was a young boy was to go out and sweep the soot off the steps because of the coal mines and the steel mills and all that stuff. But basically consider myself a blue-collar boy from Jeannette, Pennsylvania, which is really a small town. It reminds me when I was chief accountant, I was giving a speech, new chief accountant, and I used to start out that way because I want to let people know who I am. And I used the term blue-collar boy from Jeannette, Pennsylvania. Well, after the conference, some guy came up, he's a partner with D&T, Ted Bluey, and said, "Did I hear what you said right?" And I said, "Yes, well, I'm from Jeannette, Pennsylvania." And it turned out he went to school with me. And an interesting fast forward to that is Ted Bluey eventually got intrigued by the SEC and became chief accountant of the enforcement division. Spent about 2 or 3 years there helping out the enforcement function.
So you recruited from Jeannette after all that time.
Yeah, with a good speech technique, I guess. He may have been the only other person in Jeannette. But
Well, I note that you joined the U.S. Air Force in 1963 after graduating from high school. I understand, based on our conversations, you took full advantage of the educational opportunities the service offered, earning 2 years of college credit at the University of Maryland European Division. You must have been pretty ambitious at 18. Could you give us a little bit of insight into that time in your life?
Sure, Andy. Actually, when I graduated from high school, I had a pretty successful high school career. I was considering going to college, but I was economically deprived, but I was trying to get a scholarship to the Penn State, because that's where everybody went. It looked like I'd be going to Robert Morris, but I was having trouble with the scholarship thing, and along comes the draft. And Vietnam was starting to heat up then in that 60s, or I guess early 60 time frame. So I basically joined the Air Force to avoid the draft. I was had a pretty successful military career. I went to technical school out of basic training, and I did so well in technical school. The top three persons had their choice of assignment worldwide. And I was number one, so I chose Germany. And so I spent 3 years in Germany. And I also had a very interesting assignment. It was really an administrative arm of the Office of Special Investigations, which is really, hardly ever wore military uniform or anything. It was all plain clothes type thing, investigating people. It was my first experience, I think, with investigative type work, which actually continued throughout my whole career as auditor and SEC, etc. But, black market type activity. Also, another function was quality control. The base I was on had missiles, nuclear stuff. And I was with a small unit and basically just monitored the various people on that base, and including all aspects of their personal life. If they had any fights, they had any alcohol problems, money problems, any kind of thing. And I designed a system to keep track of these several thousand people color code system. You know, blues were okay, you know, yellows you had to watch a little bit, and the reds were really, you didn't want to anywhere near a missile. And that system actually was adopted Air Force-wide. They had me write it up, I sent it in. And I was actually nominated as, I was just an enlisted guy, nominated to go to the Air Force Academy, become an officer, but that would have been like an 8-year commitment, and I really had no interest in that, so I didn't do it. It's more fun doing what I was doing. I had a lot of friends who were officers, etc. Like I said, plain clothes. It was a good experience.
Now, is this the time of the Berlin Wall? Or later?
There was still a wall.
There's still.
Yeah, it came down, I think, shortly after I left Germany.
So this brings us to 1967. You leave the service and go to the University of Maryland as a psychology major.
Well, that's right. Another aspect of my military career is University of Maryland had a European division, which is pretty big. I mean, it's all over Asia, Europe, etc. And so I took advantage of that, night school, etc., regular professors would come over with temporary assignments and all that stuff, and I had about almost a year and a half of college while I was in the service. So a natural choice would be to go back to College Park and University of Maryland and continue my education, which I did. And my strong interest was psychology, and I had industrial psychology. Time and motion studies, that sort of thing. I credit that with my word power or interest in observing people and things, and even when I was an accountant, you know, just kind of less talk, more looking and listening, and it was a pretty good transference of experience. But I had completed everything I needed to do to graduate with a degree in psychology. But I needed to take some electives. So I took a couple accounting courses. Matter of fact, I took accounting 1 and 2 together, because I was kind of fast-forwarding through college. I went to summer school and all that stuff. And I took this course with a fellow by the name of Roger Hermerson, Dr. Hermerson, who wrote a book. It was brand new. The first time it was ever used was in these courses. It was kind of a programmed accounting text. So with the use of that book, but more importantly, and I still appreciate Dr. Hermerson, his enthusiasm and interest and the way he talked about and, you know, drew people through the introductory accounting courses, I became interested in accounting. And I didn't have to, but I took more accounting electives. And then I kind of figured out that to really become a good psychologist, even industrial psychology, you'd have to be a PhD. That'd have been another X number of years in school. And I was interested in work. And so accounting, you didn't really need an advanced education, although it'd be helpful. I ended up staying an extra year in school and getting my accounting degree.
It's interesting. Did your parents have college degrees?
They did not. I was probably one of the first ones to actually go to college. There's been some since then, but no, they were just hardcore, hardworking, probably lower middle class, upper, lower class, people with work ethic, and I had two sisters. And, I was the fortunate one.
It's interesting. Accounting, particularly in that period, I think did take many students and catapulted them into the professional category in one generation.
Yep.
Which is quite amazing.
Yep.
What caused you to switch to accounting? Just that interest in Hermanson, a mentor like that was sufficient?
Basically, that was all it took. That plus the recognition that I would have to go through 4 more years or more of school to get a decent job in psychology.
I judge you took the CPA exam before you left school?
I was kind of off cycle from the normal school year, so I actually graduated in January 1970. The normal school is September, you know. And I took the CPA exam the very first time I could, which was January 1970. So it's about the same time I graduated. And I was lucky enough to pass it the first time around. I said to myself, I don't want to go through this again. So I worked extra hard, got it down, got it out of the way.
And then we're off to A.M. Poland in 1970.
Yes, and that was interesting, too. I was probably one of the top students at Maryland, and Maryland was a pretty heavily recruited school, so to speak. All the big eight at that time were going nuts trying to get people. But A.M. Poland, at that time, I think the ninth largest firm in the U.S., I had just moved into D.C. They were big in the South, and they actually had offices in New York. There, their recruiting was more aggressive. And what they did is they came in a year before I graduated, or right at the time I switched to accounting, and they hired me then. And we'll pay you full-time, full salary, now, while you're in school. All you got to do is, if you can, come in Saturday at night every once in a while, and there's no commitment. And they were paying competitive salaries. And more importantly, they had a number of decent clients, a good client base. And so I took it and ran. And I was actually, I think glad. I could have went with any of the firms. But Poland, you got a broader base of experience, quicker, more responsibility. They had public companies as well as decent private companies and good training, et cetera, et cetera. So I spent about five or six years there.
Yeah. Well, we get to the SEC in 1975, and you left A.M. Poland. Was there something that sort of initiated that decision? Were you recruited by the SEC, or did this just appeal to you in some way?
I'd say three reasons. One was, like I said, A.M. Poland had some SEC-registered public companies, and I was in audits of both private and public. I noticed a big difference. I mean, people spent more time with the audit, the financial reporting requirements, and the rules were just different. And I was just impressed by that. I mean, that's just like black and white almost. I was also either fortunate or unfortunate enough to come across two cases of fraud later in my career at A.M. Poland. One was internal fraud, one was external. I guess they were both internal.
Financial reporting fraud versus an asset fraud?
Yeah, one was money stealing money from the company. The controller devised this strange scheme to just siphon off over years, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the other was where top management was kind of cooking the books. So I had those two experiences, and it was a big thing. I mean, everybody in the firm was going nuts. The latest, and what I said about public companies or private companies, that's when Sandy Burton was chief accountant of the SEC. And if you recall, he was one of the more active, aggressive chief accountants. And he was spitting out new accounting rules left and right. And I was pretty dedicated. I used to study, work overtime, whatever, to make sure I stay on top of things. And when this one public company audit that I was on, I actually missed a couple new rules. I think it was leases and taxes or something. It turned out they hit the street like in December and January, and they were effective for that year. You know, these were calendar companies. So I started studying that more, and I said, geez, I'd rather be working for that guy than out here trying to comply with the rules he's spitting out left and right. And that is true. Actually, at that time, the SEC was ramping up a little bit, although then it was still a very, very small agency, and I was the 30th CPA on the staff of the entire staff of the SEC. There was 30 CPAs. I went in and said, I want to talk to Sandy Burton. I want to work. And I told him the stories. And they said, well, you can't work for me, but you can work for the SEC. I started in the Division of Corporation Finance, and I only really expected to spend about 2 or 3 years there. Actually, it was a 3-year commitment. So 3 years, and then I'd take that experience, plus the employment experience, and go out and get a real job, you know. But it didn't work that way. Every time when you go there, you have like a 3-year commitment. It's not formal, but if you give your word, and I give my word, I keep it. And every time you get promoted, there's a 3-year commitment. Same type of deal. And I got promoted 5 times.
Oh, that's interesting. You started as a branch accountant, which I think you described as the lowest position possible. How many branch accountants were there at the time?
Well, again, like I said, I was the 30th.
You were the 30th.
I mean, there wasn't many branches, and there wasn't many accountants. There was like one to each branch that handled, a whole bunch of companies. And when I say I started at the lowest, I started at the lowest. A normal starting level at the SEC for accountants, CPAs at that time, was GS 13. Well, I didn't quite qualify for that. You know, you had to go through personnel. So I started at GS 12. I quickly got promoted to GS 13 and later 14, 15, SES 1, SES 4, whatever it was. But
it must have given you a very fast track into some of the issues that corporation finance and the SEC were dealing with. I'd like to hear about some of those.
Well, Corp Fin and a branch accountant to me is still probably the most important job at the SEC. The chief accountant gets a lot of visibility and publicity, and as you know, but they're the closest to the company. You get to know the industry, the company. It's kind of the first line of defense outside the auditing profession. The review and comment process is very, very important. It certainly has evolved over time, but back then I used to study the filings. Most just look at the financial statements. I look at the entire filing from front to back. And I used to give speeches about this. It seemed to me that sometimes in a public company, there was a husband and wife team. The husband did the financial statements. The wife did the MD&A and the text. And like many husbands and wives, they didn't communicate very well. I mean, it's like black and white. The MD&A, Management Discussion Analysis, didn't really track what was in the financial statements and vice versa. It's a good way to get a lot of comments when you were reviewing your filing.
Did you come across any financial reporting frauds or find that you had identified problems that subsequently were shown to be at least material errors in the financial reporting?
Yeah, there was a few of them, and I actually got rapidly identified as somebody who, probably by mistake, could find these things. That was very fast, but I will not mention names. But one big company, in their 10Q quarterly filing, you know, the SEC had this rule. I used to, if they didn't comply with the rules, I'd give them a comment. Well, I don't know if they still have this rule, but it said you had to have a commitments and contingencies line item on your financial statement. And there was no requirement to cross-reference notes or anything, but you just had to have it there. So one very big Fortune 10 company did not have it. So I gave them the comment. And I didn't know you could waive comments or make them future. Nobody's ever told me that. So I said they had to amend it. So I had half the free world come down on me. These people visited me, you know, the CFO. But I held my ground. Sorry, you got to amend it. And it turns out, and this might have been just a coincidence, but this company, and it was widely reported in the press, at about that same time disclosed a massive, let's call it contingency, that threatened really the company. The stock which just went down. Now, it eventually got resolved. The company's still around, I believe. But that was one interesting experience. And because I was considered to be fairly good, I guess, also during that time frame, the 76, I believe, the SEC was looking into New York City, their bond problems. They had a big bond fiasco, and they needed bodies to do this investigation. I mean, half the SEC was up in New York. And so they went to Corp Fin. I was at Corp Fin, and they said, I need a couple good people. It turned out I was one of them. So all of a sudden, I'm on a plane up there working with Stanley Sporkin and some of these legends. Went on raids. And
went on raids?
Well, there was a problem. It's still uncertain, I believe, what authority the SEC has over municipal securities. It's a little bit more nebulous and indirect than it does public companies. And so at that time, it was even worse, I think. I wish the SEC had direct authority, because now that I'm retired, I have a lot of municipal bonds. But apparently New York was a little reluctant to let the SEC come in and look at all this stuff. Anyhow, that was a couple good weeks of experience with the enforcement division, and I've spending a lot of time studying the New York City pension plan, my God, and writing. There was a big 800-page report on the investigation of New York City by the SEC. I wrote the pension appendix, which I think was one or two pages, mm-hmm. in 2 weeks.
But you met some interesting people as well.
Yep.
How old were you at that point?
I was pretty young. I had to be 30s.
Well, it must have been exciting. Now, you told me at one point in one of our conversations, you consider the branch accountants to be still the most important members of the SEC staff. Why is that?
Because a good branch accountant can catch things. And they have a lot of technology and tools now to assist them, but that's really the first line of defense. And that external review of a company's SEC filings is still, I think, one of the more unique things to the U.S. regulatory system. You have somebody really looking and challenging, et cetera. And a good example, and I hate to use one everybody has really referred to before, is Enron. If somebody had looked at Enron, and I understand it's public knowledge that they, for some reason, that wasn't picked for review. But I went back and looked at it after the fact, and it easily would have been able to challenge a number of things in that filing that might have brought this stuff to light a little bit earlier.
This always raises in my mind a kind of a question that we really hadn't talked about at all, and that is, how is it that the branch accountant with public information is able to ferret these things out, but they managed to get to the SEC with a filing? How come the first line of defense didn't work?
I can't answer that. But things have changed. We might get back into that a little bit later. But
okay. All right. Well, you went to the office of the chief accountant in, was it 77 or 78? On a special assignment from Corp Fin. Apparently there was a sort of an intern program. You were only expected to be there a year. During that period, I understand you had a special assignment. Would you like to give us a little insight into the special assignment? And then maybe we can transition into how you managed to stay in OCA.
Okay. Actually, that was at the time, 77, of the Moss-Metcalf hearings, and Eagleton, Dingell, etc. I mean, the accounting profession was really under a lot of scrutiny, and the SEC was, too. And so they needed help to prepare some reports that were promised to Congress during congressional hearings by the SEC. And so something called a Staff Accounting Fellowship Program was set up. That was six-month assignments to the Office of Chief Accountant from Corp Fin, and it was basically just they needed bodies. So I was one of, I think I was the first, no, it was two of us, branch accountant to participate in that program, and I pretty much exclusively for 6 months worked around the clock, including the middle of the night, on these reports to Congress, which are, I think in the Historical Society archives, it's this thick. And because I did fairly well with those assignments, I was asked to stay on in the chief accountant's office.
Stop just a moment and ask, what any reflections on the Moss Metcalf activities other than your kind of personal participation looking back? Think they had much impact?
There was a series of evolutions of people tightening up, both the SEC, the accounting profession, the corporate industry, securities, financial world. But if you go back and reread those things, it's the same issues that were later addressed, and almost the same issues in Sarbanes-Oxley. It's the same thing. It just doesn't seem to change. Things didn't go far enough then, or they thought they could be worked out. I don't know.
Yeah, I remember as a young faculty member going through that thick binder you're talking about and looking at it. And when I look back too, I don't know what changed we might have avoided some of the current problems. Sure, corporation finance expected you to return after that assignment, but you did not. You stayed with OCA. And what was your first assignment there? Maybe you could kind of talk us through your career in OCA up to the chief accountant's position. I have a long list of things I know you were involved in, all major issues of the time. I'd like very much to hear about those.
Well, I started out in OCA. Again, like I said, I never went back to Corp Fin, and they weren't very happy about that. But as a regular old staff accountant, and became assistant chief accountant, deputy chief accountant, and chief accountant. It went by very, very fast. I should mention, when I was in Corp Fin, I was fortunate enough to work very closely with a guy by the name of Charlie Ogilby, who was the SEC to the banking industry. Banking is probably still is, but was certainly then one of the biggest number of registrants were banks and banking-type entities. And Charlie was retiring, so I became, quote, the SEC's banking expert. So I worked on bank stuff. And when I was in chief accountant's office, I continued to specialize in banking issues, which made you very popular with the banks, big, little, and medium. But I worked on, and had a good reputation for working hard, so I worked on, the first staff accounting bulletin and many others, whole range of different kinds of issues like push down accounting, divestitures, split ups, spin offs, carve outs. I worked on primarily responsible for the efforts of the SEC to codify the staff accounting bulletins and the financial reporting releases. The first indicator, I keep hearing it today, but back then, things were too complex. There's too many different things. They're all over the place. So we decided to put them all in one publication and kind of, quote, codify them. And it was one of the feeble attempts at simplification of the rules.
But you created the staff accounting bulletins.
The very first one. And we also created the first financial reporting release. Prior to that time, they were accounting, AARs, accounting and auditing releases. And they finally realized that you can't just focus on accounting and auditing. It's a broader picture, just like the rest of the world today. Financial reporting. So we created a financial reporting release, one. Now they're up to Lord knows how many. To recognize a broader range of topics that would be dealt with, MD&A, et cetera, stuff related to but outside the financial statements.
Now, a staff accounting bulletin is not a rule.
But you better comply with it.
Yes. I thought I'd just throw that in because I know that during my time there, it was interesting. These are not rules. These are interpretations. But they are basically pretty much have to adhere to them.
Yep.
Now, you were also involved. You said you were specialized in banks. The S&L crisis shows up in here someplace.
That was really a big issue. With many, many hearings, a lot of problems with the S&Ls. Absolutely incredible situation where you have interest rate deregulation and financial structure out there with the S&Ls, they couldn't deal with it, so everybody got into real estate. But we just spent tons of time working with our sister agencies and Federal Home Loan Bank Board and FSLIC, Congress, et cetera. There were some real issues there, real problems. Now, most of the S&Ls, as you know, back then did not report to the SEC. They were really have this special niche in the legislation that caused them to report their filings and all that stuff to the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. And only if they formed a holding company would they come to the SEC, and very few were holding companies. And so, but those that were, we ended up dealing with, and of course they needed capital, so more and more holding companies were being formed, and more of these S&Ls, sludge, were coming to the SEC.
Didn't the Congress get involved with essentially legislating some accounting that managed to keep them afloat for a little while? Was the SEC in any way involved with that, or opposing it, or proposing it?
There were some issues there, and the SEC was consulted and involved. it was a very, very difficult issue, though, very political. I said the bank board would have had the most direct, Federal Home Loan Bank Board, direct authority there, and they were proposing a rule to mark to market, which is actually a good idea, I guess, the S&L portfolio, but to defer a loss over like 30 or 40 or 50, 60 years, I forget, it was an amazing thing. And of course, the SEC didn't agree with that. And so it was this big political thing.
I'm going to go back to something a little more like the SABs and the FRSs. I have a question. You were also involved with the formation of the EITF, I believe, in 84.
Yeah, that was formed when I was there, and I got involved with that, and of course stayed involved throughout my career at the SEC. A very, very important function, interesting function, where you have all the top tactical people from all the firms with FASB involvement, SEC involvement, and a whole range of interesting issues. I think the SEC did try to support that by giving them the first dib, so to speak, to try to deal with some of these issues. And if not, then, of course, you'd always have the SAB or financial reporting release or just what the SEC occasionally can do, just an edict, just say it in speeches.
Now, looking back and looking at how the EITF has functioned, almost at times as a sort of a mini FASB, it seemed, setting rules for certain accounting issues. Mm-hmm. Do you think it was a net positive contribution, that it really has done its job, or do you see problems, things that might need consideration?
You mean to have an EITF type function?
Yeah, through that period, right.
I thought it was a net benefit. Again, you had some good people there. You had the SEC and FASB oversight, so couldn't go too far off the reservation. And there were some frustrations, but I think generally they did a good job. There's some tough issues there. The SEC didn't really want to deal with some of these things. I mean,
right.
Could hardly pronounce them, let alone figure out how to account for them. But they did a pretty good job, I think.
I know something else you I know were interested in was the globalization issue at that time, which is actually you were ahead of your time, I suppose, in even being interested in it in the United States. But today, of course, it's a big issue, and it looks like we're moving well forward on the matter. How did this all get started with you?
Kind of think of the time frame now, but slowly but surely, creeping up into the late 80s, there was a tremendous increase in, first of all, the number of foreign companies that filed with the SEC. But more important than politically and otherwise was the absolute tremendous growth of the markets outside the U.S. London, Japan, Germany, and interestingly, one of the cited reasons for this growth in capital raising was the SEC's rules were too tough. You know, the accounting particularly, and all securities lawyers, everybody mentioned accounting. And so we spent a tremendous amount of time dealing with foreign counterparts in the regulatory area, foreign companies, the exchanges, New York Stock Exchange, etc. I spent a lot of time overseas trying to deal with that phenomena of globalization, which they still are doing. The SEC issued a concept release asking all kind of questions about international and international accounting standards and all that stuff. It's very similar to the more release the SEC issued just two or three weeks ago, or maybe a month ago. Same type of questions. We started working with the IASC. It's obviously a different name now, but they wanted to become more of a player, and they said, well, you tighten up your standards and get rid of all the options, and we'll consider you. And all of a sudden, they started doing it. And so we had to work with them. It's just an amazing issue that all the different people involved. And it's still not resolved. And one of the big issues, and just fast forward here, with globalization, was identified back then, and this was in the 80s, identified today, and that is if you have a good set of international standards, and that's both regulatory and accounting, why do you need a FASB? I mean, if it's good enough for Mercedes-Benz, it's good enough for General Motors. And so it'll be interesting to see how it's resolved, because it's the same issue back in the late 80s. It was on the table, a very, very big concern.
I was there when there was an intermediate also concept release.
It's been at least 3 years.
Yeah. And one of the issues that arose at that time was that even if we had very common accounting standards, and everybody could agree, and we didn't have the argument about what to do with the particular national level organizations like the FASB. What about the fact that the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission seems to be somewhat unique in the level of effort and resources they put into making sure that what does come in does in fact conform to those standards? Other countries don't seem to have that kind of regulatory organization. Did you, as you went through this process yourself, did you encounter that same thing?
Yes. I think some of the foreign regulators, say non-U.S., I should say, have been beefing up. They're trying to adopt some of the concepts and techniques and whatever, the U.S. regulatory structure, but are still the SEC-type structures are vastly, and I hate to use the word superior, but I mean, just it's got more. Mm-hmm. And so that's an issue to be reckoned with. It's one thing to have good standards, but if you don't have somebody or the same quality of external review, that's both auditing and mm-hmm. regulatory, then you have a different situation. And so that's going to be still an issue on the table. I think that's going to win. What's going to win the day, frankly?
That's what's going to win today.
Depends on what you mean by win, but
well, let me rephrase that. What is your opinion? Do you think that it will kind of come out that say IFRS will become the standard, and then we will adopt it in the U.S.? Do you think that's foreseeable?
I think it's foreseeable, and there'll still be a need for a FASB type entity to participate in international, but also to deal with the stuff that's homegrown. We still have a very, very biggest complex market in the world, mm-hmm. and so there's going to be issues that need to be dealt with. But it'll be a different way of doing business.
The other side of this picture is the auditing standards themselves. We have the auditing profession gets in, performs the audit, and then we have the regulatory groups in these various nations. And the international auditing standards developments have come along in recent years. Do you see that as an issue as well? The firms have largely, the big ones at least, let's say the Global Six today, have all developed international networks. There are issues of common quality and independence across those networks that are still being worked out. Do you see how that might unfold in the next few years?
Yeah, it's the same issue as accounting standards, independence, ethics, auditing. We all still have a lot of pressure and need for uniform standards, but also uniform application and enforcement and regulation. And so they're all really together. That's a tougher one because culturally people are different. I think the firms they do recognize that. They are trying to deal with it, and things are tightening up. But that's going to be a tough nut.
Do you see that during your career, Tark? I know by 2004, everybody was concerned about the international markets and the international auditing standards and independent standards. Did you see that tightening up coming through Ernst & Young and the other firms' systems?
Absolutely. And actually, I was just at the a meeting down in Orlando, the Ernst & Young Retired Partners meeting, and that was a big theme of the whole meeting, was talking about the efforts at globalization, convergence, etc. Tremendous amount of money and thought and effort in those areas because they realize it's a global market.
I think the profession is interested in seeing then common standards on both auditing and financial reporting and common regulatory processes. They have a problem with our legal environment. Seems to be quite different than the legal environment in some of these other countries where we have contingent fees and mind block here.
Well, I know what you mean. We definitely have different litigation environments. The firms understand that, and that's been a blockade because they put up Chinese, sort of Chinese walls. But I think people are starting to recognize, and I've talked to people at a very, very high policy level, that's just tough. Because you just can't operate as separate blocks. It's got to be one firm worldwide. The clients are multinational. They're not all U.S., et cetera. And so you just got to bite the bullet.
So firms have to just basically get in there, develop common quality and independent standards.
And cooperative initiatives, et cetera.
You dealt with some interesting independence issues when you were at the SEC. I think you mentioned one where you had to deal with the issue of the firms coming to talk to you about prime subcontract type arrangements with clients.
Right? Oh, that was interesting. I'll never forget that one because that's when I was first chief accountant. Clarence Sampson, my predecessor. And by the way, I was the seventh chief accountant. I considered myself lucky to talk to people. The youngest also. But the very first issue was as Clarence Sampson was leaving. the firms came in with a formal petition to have the commission interpret the rules to allow certain types of business relationships with audit clients. What do I need, the first thing? And I can't win. So I say yes, then you're a friend of the profession and you're not a regulator if I say no. But anyhow, that went on I think there was a second petition filed after the first one was kind of reluctantly approved in the staff's recommendation not to allow these things for various reasons. But another petition was filed. He's proposing some different techniques to deal with it, and that I don't think I ever got acted on. So, but a lot of the commissioners were favorably the five-member commission. A lot of them were favorably inclined to allow these types of things to occur.
By the time you left in '91, the firms had substantially increased their consulting practices. So I suppose this was part of what was embedded in these questions, the nature of the relationship they could have with a client as they expanded the amount of work they did with the client that wasn't particularly an audit or other kind of assurance activity.
Yeah, this really came out of the consulting business growth and the perceived inhibition that was caused by not being able to deal with audit clients. A big piece of the market was cut out for some of the really big firms. And as you know, the consulting divisions continued to grow massive, and probably one of the on balance good things that have happened is eventually they all got shut away. Sold off, spun off, IPO'd. I was happy to see that. I think Ernst & Young was the first one to get rid of the, I shouldn't say get rid of it, divest itself of the big ticket consulting business, so to speak. But I think on balance that's good. They just really couldn't coexist.
Tell me something else about your career in OCA. Some of the more exciting things that you did.
Well, I don't know about exciting, but let me just mention a couple things. I was promoted to deputy chief accountant, which was the only one. I think today they have like three. You were one. And I had to be hired by the chairman, John Shad, the head of Merrill Lynch, who was a great guy. I really liked him. But anyhow, he interviewed me, and he's looking through my stuff and says, wait a minute, how come you don't have an advanced degree, master's, graduate degree? And I said, I do. My degree's in OJT, and I got an A+. That was the end of the interview. I was in. And chief accountant, Clarence Sampson retired, and I was the last homegrown chief accountant. Most of the others were, all the others were from outside, but I had a little trepidation. I was barely 40 years old. I think I was 39 or something. But supported by all segments of the financial community, including academic, and David Reuter was then, who I really, really appreciate as a really solid securities lawyer who did a great job as chairman, but he had to hire me, and his main point was they needed to have more enforcement presence. Because after all, the SEC is an enforcement agency. And so I used to give a lot of speeches talking about that, you know, because I don't think very few accountants really appreciate it. And what they do is help enforce the securities law. These are laws. Accounting's not just a science, it's a law for public companies. So our motto back then, and I used to always go around the country talking about it, we're going to be tough but fair. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I think after I left, things got tough, but not fair. But, yeah, interestingly, just this couple days ago, I ran into Con Hewitt, who's the current chief accountant of the SEC, and in a quick conversation, we readily both agreed that being chief accountant's like drinking Colt 45 in that old commercial, you know, the only unique experience. And it truly was. I got involved in a whole bunch of issues. We mentioned globalization, etc. Another one was a foreign loan crisis. That was the tip of the iceberg, or at least ties into globalization, because here's where all the major banks around the world had exposure to MBNA, Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina loans that obviously were a problem, and the key issues there were how to deal with it. They were entering the transactions to get them off the books, and when do you have to mark them down, etc. And I spent a lot of time overseas, the Treasury Department, the State Department, everybody got involved in this one, let alone the Hill. Federal Reserve Board attended meetings of all my counterparts and from all the banking agencies around the world, all the security regulators. Actually, not them all, just me. They cared about the SEC at that point. But we realized we had to come up with a common solution because there was too many banks offshore that were big, massive banks, still are, that had the same problem, and you couldn't treat U.S. banks differently, et cetera, et cetera. But boy, I lost a few pounds on that one. Spent a lot of time on that stuff. You may remember internal control. We got, you know, Treadway Commission. Remember that? You know, proposed reporting on internal control way back when. Was it in the mid-70s or something? Mid-80s. But we tried to do it back then and couldn't do it, and eventually it got done. Now they're trying to tinker down with it a bit. Hope not. The other quick issue I dealt with was a mark-to-market accounting under Richard Breeden, another chairman, who had a tremendous interest in this because of his work with the S&L crisis, working for the White House. And so that was a tremendous, tremendous experience. The only other thing I'd mention, Andy, is it was some pleasure I noticed that the two people that worked for me at the SEC subsequently became chief accountants, Lynn Turner, as you know, and Bob Herdman. So that was an interesting experience. But I left at the end of my last three-year commitment. Exactly. I mean, it was exactly, went to work in January of 75, left in January of 91, three-year commitments. Plus, I must say, I had two boys who were both going to Ivy League school and on a government salary, no matter how high you are. That's hard to do.
I'm going to go back before we make the transition to leaving. You mentioned they're tinkering with 404, which is the SEC's part of the internal control issue, and AS2, which is the PCOB's part. What's your take on that one? Do you see the integrated audit that they have in place as working conceptually okay, but needing adaptation to make it practically workable?
I'm a little bit worried about adaptation, because if you end up watering it down and not having the auditors do enough work, you're going to end up with problems. You're going to double problems. We talked about the litigation environment. It's just cost to get good internal control reporting. Now, they have the banking model. They could follow that. That appears to work fairly well, although that's a highly regulated industry, so it's a little bit different. But so I didn't need to be very careful with the with that adaptation, so to speak, and don't try to get it on the cheap.
I was interested in asking about that one because you were in at the front end of the internal control reporting issue, and we now have internal reporting on the books, but we do have a lot of pushback on it. And the other one that's coming, which you were in on the front end of as well, is the fair value reporting. Mm-hmm. And the FASB's proposal on that, which is fairly expansive, I think, compared to what you were talking about at the time. Any views on how that might play out as well? Is it workable?
I have reservations about that. You can only go so far. It's weird to have part of your balance sheet fair value, not others, but at the same time, worked a lot with valuation people over time, and I just don't think we're there yet. Maybe one of these days.
It's interesting that you dealt with all the critical issues that seem to be on the table today, and you dealt with them early, and we're still struggling with them.
It is amazing. Some things just don't change.
Yeah. Now, in 1991, you left the SEC. You mentioned your boys were in Ivy League schools, and that you don't make that much at the in government work. You went to Ernst & Young, and I note that you have had a fair number of duties and responsibilities there that span many of the same issues that you had dealt with at the SEC. If you'd like to spend a few minutes just giving us an idea that you're sort of post-SEC time, I'm sure people would be interested in what you found it to be like on the other side of the table, so to speak.
All right, Andy. I went to Ian Wise's national office in New York, and frankly, not sure Ian Wise knew what to do with me. What do you do with a chief accountant? I hadn't had any practical audit experience for quite a while. So their idea was really to get me involved in some of their firm policy making publications, be on some committees, etc. But when I got to the SEC, put me in an office, and the phone started ringing.
Ernst & Young.
Yeah, this is E&Y. And It was clients, people, client handlers, audit partners, all over the place, constant. And what I was really impressed with and still am, and I don't think people appreciate this too much, is that almost all these calls were people looking for help. They were dealing with a client who wanted a certain kind of accounting and they needed some analysis and input and ammunition to say no. Because it didn't feel right, it didn't look right, it didn't smell right. And so I became really a technical consultant guy, probably 20 hours a day for the first 5 years or something. Sometimes I had to deal with the clients directly. I had more chargeable time than a typical audit partner. And I found that just to be very impressive because in all cases, they were companies looking for good solutions to problems they had, or our people looking for help in dealing with an increasingly complex society. I dealt with a lot of international work, a lot of foreign IPOs, which continue, although I note with interest that London had the largest capital raising last year. So it's interesting. Revenue recognition, which was a big issue with the SEC. I mean, it dealt with all kind of those kind of questions. And then I became an M&A specialist, mergers and acquisitions. Every single big deal that occurred during that time frame in the mid-90s, which was pretty hot and heavy, I was involved in. I didn't, kind of a pooling expert, so to speak, worked with all the other firms, financial industry, securities lawyers, etc. So it was interesting. As time evolved, though, I got involved in some other stuff. Probably the biggest one was independence. All the new rules that were coming out. Like I said, the sale of consulting by the firms. That took up increasing amounts of time as time went on. That's one area I wish the SEC and would get into and simplify. I mean, right now there's illogic to it. It doesn't make sense. But they're rules. You got to follow them. Mm-hmm. If they could come up with a logical set, hopefully global standards, that were fairly easy to understand and follow, I think everybody would be a lot better off. They have some strange rules.
Do you think principles-based rules in accounting, auditing, independence are workable generally, or maybe specifically in the United States, where we face a litigation system that seems to say, well, show me the rule?
Well, it's changing a bit, but you can't just have principles, as most people understand that. You got to have principles plus, but it ought to be principles based. It might need some additional elaboration, and it definitely would need some additional elaboration and a few rules sprinkled in, but nonetheless, you'd have at least the 10 commandments that I can understand those. Mm-hmm. And if you understand commandment 3, then the rules underneath it would be logically tied to 3. And so distant relationships and issues wouldn't affect independence, but others would, and people would concentrate on those. We'd be better off, I think.
You enjoyed your time at Ernst & Young, I take it?
It went very fast. I mean, 91, and all of a sudden, then it's 2004, and I'm eligible for retirement early, fully vested. I took it.
Well, looks like a good retirement.
Not bad. I'm learning all kind of new stuff post-retirement, so great. And I'm still young enough to go back to work.
Oh, well. Do you sense a change in the SEC over this period of time? Do you see any trends within the SEC that, from the time you began to today, performing the same role essentially, but just more of it with more people, or have they altered their role in some way as you see it?
Well, it certainly got bigger. More technology, more people. And that's probably deserved. I mean, the world's bigger, more complex. So you need those additional people. You need more technology. But some things have not changed at all, the basic functions, the oversight, review, and comment, etc. There's more of a direct regulatory role now with Sarbanes-Oxley, so that imposes more responsibility, etc. But when you get right down to it, and it goes back to the emphasis on the branch accountant, that hasn't changed. I mean, there's no robots or technology that's going to change the ability of somebody to look at a filing externally and challenge it, review it. That keeps people on their toes throughout.
This wasn't on our list, but let me ask anyway. The current chairman, Cox, is very strong on XBRL and the development of that as a filing mechanism. And I think there is some thought that not robots, but expert systems, so to speak, might contribute to the ability to the branch accountant do an even better job.
It might. I must admit I haven't fully analyzed the pros and cons of that, but there's no panacea out there. And if you have a good branch accountant, you don't need it.
Too much of the rest of it.
Right.
Well, post-Enron, we're now sort of, we have the FASB, and now we have the PCAOB. We're a much more regulated industry. In addition, I guess everybody's refocused on the financial statements, both management and the auditor. Do you have any kind of comments that you might like to make about profession or our business in general in the post-Enron era?
Just a couple quick things. Obviously, what happened, i.e., Sarbanes-Oxley was hard to stop. It was a train. And on balance, I think it's been good. I've dealt with the firms, talked to people in the firms today, and I think it's caused a refocus that's needed and good. And I think you're going to see a much better profession. You're going to have less risk, liability-wise, et cetera, because they're going to be doing more work, better work. They have to. You have somebody, PCOB, and I know some of the people there personally. They'll come in and challenge and look and review. I mean, you're right there. Things have just tightened up substantially. More of a refocus on the audit function and the need for good auditing and the importance in society, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, on balance, it's been good. It's a shame, you know, lots and lots of people got hurt as a result of some of these fiascos, but that happens, something's got to change, and it has.
Yeah, I have this feeling that somehow we lost faith in the audit, and maybe we found out through this process that it really is important.
That is correct. That's correct.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add? Anything at all?
I think that's it, Andy. I think we covered quite a bit. And I appreciate the time I spent with you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Ed. Your interview will become a part of the SEC Historical Society Oral History Project Archives. I read a lot of history personally, and I think we're very often, as Americans, not terribly interested in our history. We're sort of go to the next problem and solve that problem. But I think the Society has a good program here, and I think your contribution to it will be appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thank you.